I am Sarah Kennedy. I'm a 12-month fellow in the Education Department here at MoMA. And I'm going to be speaking to you today about my NYU thesis, my master's thesis, titled The Art of Effecting Change, New Activist Practices in Environmental Art. So I decided to write my thesis about looking at two different aspects of the world that I was interested in, art and environment, and finding a way to pair the two. I was interested in further exploring art's capacity as a change agent, and I am particularly interested in environmental issues, and so wanted to somehow engage that into my investigation. And I did had the opportunity through MoMA to have to apply for a travel grant, and so I was able to go to Los Angeles and meet some of the artists that were working within the area that I was interested in. So some of the talk that I'm going to be presenting to you today shows some compelling projects that are taking place in Los Angeles. This by no means excludes other areas, but in 45 minutes I can only give you a very small sampling of some of the people that are and artists and collaboratives that are working in this vein. I also want to suggest that you keep an open mind, because many of these projects really do stretch the boundaries of how we think about art and specific definitions of what modern and contemporary art is. So keep an open mind and feel free to ask questions throughout as I carry you through some of these projects. So I'm going to start with just giving you a brief outline. I feel that it's hard to tell you about the contemporary works before giving you some sort of a basis of how I arrived at the frameworks that elucidate all of the different components and levels of engagement that these artists are working within with regard to the environment and ecology. So I'm going to tell you briefly about some of the conceptual frameworks that have come out of my research, and then I'm going to take you back through some of the historical precedents that set up the terrain for environmentalism and then movement into art practices from there. And then I will introduce you to some of the contemporary works, and then specifically tell you about a few projects that are notable to me that I had the opportunity to have firsthand discussions with some of the artists and collaborators in Los Angeles. So first and foremost, I guess the key aspect of my thesis was looking at the role that art can play as a change agent to engage the public in environmental issues. So I'm going to just read this quote by Patricia Sanders, who's an art and humanities historian. "Art, with its ability to symbolize complex abstractions in concrete ways, has unique potential for raising awareness and advancing the shift in mindset that must occur for the sake of our survival and well-being." So this is sort of a quote that I believe led me in the direction that I went with my thesis, which was really that environmentally conscious art can be an effective medium, not necessarily to change the world per se, but to help people to understand environmental issues better and confront aspects of real change within that, within personal paradigm shifts that take place in that understanding. So I'm looking specifically contemporarily at artists adopting more socially constructive aims in their creative endeavors. Peggy Cyphers, who wrote in the Art and Ecology Journal, really gives a nice quote about this idea of looking at creating a new relationship between nature and culture. It's about deconstructing, quote, existing paradigms of nature as other. Instead, contemporary artists are establishing new definitions of nature that exceed romantic notions of the landscape as this huge expanse, and rejecting the detached rhetoric of postmodernism. So the art that I'm going to be telling you about is art that blurs the line between art and activism and really performs in the place where it's licensing agency within the people that participate in the projects. And like I said, participation is inherently a really important part of this work. It is operative in structure. These works that I'm going to be showing you are operative in structuring participation and community engagement. And it's very much a necessity of the work that the community becomes involved. Also, the concept that consciousness raising within these works has to be followed by empowerment is critical. That it's not enough to just show an idea or a position or expose something related to an environmental concern, but that it is through the participation, it is through the empowerment and the agency that is afforded to the people who become a part of each of these projects that the paradigm shift actually takes place and that there's a change in the way that people conceive of their environment. Another aspect is that these projects are often interdisciplinary. They are often about bridging or collaborating between disciplines, art, science, history, policy. There's a lot of different bridges that are created, and many of the artists work in tandem with scientists and other people working in different disciplines to understand the issues that they're looking at. And finally, that these projects really challenge and ask people to broaden the definitions of art. They're often non-object-based. Some of the works that I will show you are object-based, but many of them sort of exist outside institutional structures of the traditional way that we conceive of art. So I'm going to just give you a little bit of a historical background. I'm going to tell you about some of the early land art movement people who were part of the early land art movement and earthworks movement. But first, I'm just going to give you a tiny little history of environmentalism and sort of where this whole trend began. It can be traced back all the way to the writings of Henri Thoreau, who reflected upon simpler living within natural surroundings, and John Muir, who also celebrated the beauty and truth of the landscape. So looking back to some of these reflections about land. But then also, the environmental movement took on a sort of a proactive stance, and many people cite in 1962, Rachel Carson, who was a biologist, a writer, and an ecologist, wrote Silent Spring, and it was a writing that challenged the practices of agricultural scientists and the government with regard to sort of calling for a change in humankind's perceptions and relationship with ecology and the natural world. And her research and writings really focused on pesticides use and really made clear that nature does not function in isolation, and that she was emphasizing the interconnectedness of all pollution-causing actions, and that really contemplation really needed to go into some of the technological advances that were being perpetrated on the environment. The first annual Earth Day occurred in 1970, with the aim of empowering activists and citizens worldwide to connect, interact, and impact within their communities, their environments that they were living in, and to create positive change in the way of policy, locally, nationally, and globally. So these are some of the initiatives that prompted environmental citizenship and the environmental movement gaining impetus, progressive actions giving it impetus to move forward. And another figure that is worth noting is Joseph Beuys, who's often cited as the grandfather of the environmental movement. He was a German artist who founded the Green Party in the late 1970s, and who also co-founded the Free University for Creativity and Interdisciplinary Research in 1972. And one of his groundbreaking projects that I'll tell you about was called 7,000 Oaks, which began at Documenta 7, which was an international art exhibition in Kassel, Germany. And in 1982, this project took place that basically was about harnessing the collective citizens and promoting international responsibility. And it was a project that involved planting 7,000 trees throughout the greater city of Kassel. And it took 5 years to complete, so the last tree was planted in 1987 at Documenta 8. So that's just an example of some of the early movers within this movement. So I'll just tell you briefly what you're looking at the screen here is Robert Smithson, Spiral Jetty, Michael Heitzer's Double Negative, and Walter de Maria's Lightning Field. These are having told you a little bit about some of the conditions that prompted environmentalism, these are some of the artists that really were considered the founders of the land art movement. And they positioned themselves as rejecting institutional forces, sort of taking distance from the art world circuit and denying the object-based art. They were criticized, however, for being dominant over nature, showing this man dominating over nature, disruptions in the land that could not be repaired. So it was about using earth or moving earth to create their art. So here you're looking at Robert Smithson's Spiral Jetty, which was created in 1970. And for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it is a man-made sculpture made of rock, salt, and earth, and it's in Great Salt Lake, Utah. And it's basically a massive intervention in the landscape where he moved around these different materials and created this spiral. It measures 1,500 feet long by 15 feet wide. So it's, if you can imagine, it's colossal. And you're looking at an aerial view of it, obviously. Michael Heitzer's Double Negative is consists of two trenches that have been cut into the eastern edge of the Mormon Mesa in northwestern Overton, Nevada, and he did this in 69 and 70. And it's basically two trenches that together measure also 1,500 feet long, 50 feet deep, and 30 feet wide. So if you can imagine, you can really, this involves a huge amount of moving of earth, and it really can only be seen as far as two little tiny bits of negative space from above, and you see it within the shadow that is created by the great amount of sunlight that's in that particular geographical area. And then finally, Walter Demaria's Lightning Field, which is located in New Mexico. And it consists of 400 polished stainless steel poles that have been installed in a grid array that is sort of, all of the poles are different heights, but they measure 1 mile by 1 kilometer. And it is intended to be experienced over an extended period of time, this particular work. So you go there and you experience, what we're seeing here is an image with lightning actually coming down on the rods. This doesn't happen all the time, as you can imagine, in New Mexico. But this is a particularly iconic image of it. So to take you then, environmental art began with personal gestures in the landscape that then developed to exist at the cross-section of alternative practices, which I'm going to be getting into. These are alternative practices, obviously, but then it evolved to be a little bit more socially activist. So there was this willingness to move beyond the conventions of art making and to engage with ways that political meanings are shaped in the complex field of social interactions that we're going to see. So I'm going to tell you just a little bit about the movement from this land art male domination over nature into ecofeminism, which I will define. Feminism emerged in the 1970s in tandem with environmentalism, and there was a field of thought that came to be called ecofeminism that really looked at the way that women artists were looking at art in a different way. They recognized differently than some of their male counterparts had that art can be aesthetically and functionally charged. So it was this idea that art could be socially effective. And it was more about reclamation and openness and reciprocity within the landscape, with regard to ecological issues. And it was much more about correcting imbalances that had been perpetrated by humankind, and about interconnectedness. And so, it really, really reflects a commitment to social transformation, which we see sort of in the mix of art, ecology, and community action. So this is an artist named Mirle Latterman-Ukeles who created a work that we're looking at here called Flow City that existed for quite some time. She was doing an artist in residence at the Marine Transfer at 59th Street on the Hudson River. And this particular project involved three different spaces within the Marine Transfer, where she was highlighting urban waste management within the city of New York, and she was looking at, she created a large-scale walk through the Marine Transfer as a viewing station for the observation of this continual process of urban waste and garbage disposal. So that she had set up three different viewing areas, one being where the actual garbage could be seen as it was cleared through, and the laborers who were going through the garbage could be looked at as they prepared garbage to be put on barges to be moved to the landfill. a second station where you could see the panorama of New York from which the garbage was coming, and then a third educational area where she had enlisted scientists, experts, geologists, ecologists to talk about different aspects of this phenomenon, this garbage waste, an urban waste phenomenon that was taking place in a city like New York, especially in the 1970s. So she was highlighting it, and various videos showed different perspectives of that. So she had this interest in creating points of access for the community to engage in participation or dialogue about ecological issues. And the last piece that you're seeing here called The Social Mirror was created in 1983, and it was a sanitation truck faced in mirrored glass. And the concept was that as the vehicle moved through the streets of Manhattan, the reflection of the city residents was seen on the side of the truck, therefore sort of reflecting back to the population the people responsible for the garbage glut in the first place. So they were squarely put in the limelight. Another piece by her. The second eco-feminist that I'd like to tell you about is Agnes Dean, and she created this work called Wheatfield, A Confrontation, in 1982. And it was basically 2 acres of wheat that she planted and harvested in the Battery Park landfill in the summer of 1982. And bringing together art and agriculture, this was a very site-specific piece, and of course it was before Battery Park existed. It was a landfill at the time. But she was concerned with raising awareness about hunger, worldwide hunger, and environmental politics and how those two intersected. The piece was obviously in very close proximity to the world's financial center at the time, Wall Street, and where massive transactions were taking place every day. And so she was trying to create a discussion within that arena, and thinking about what that meant, how environmental politics could affect this massive problem of hunger worldwide and poverty. Moving along into the frameworks that I created to try to discuss different levels of engagement within contemporary art practices, I decided to divide them into 3 groupings. One being reveal, the second being inform, and 3 being activate. And I will take you through each of these and show examples of each to try to help you understand the different levels of activation that were being created from the late 1970s and 80s throughout to today. So the first eco-conscious artists and collectives sought to critique the everyday life, but they also were borrowing from and moving forward from some of the ideas that had begun in these historical precedents. And the new group embraced performance and theory, as well as more radically activist practices that we're going to see. So the first group is Reveal. And the works that you're seeing here are by Andy Goldsworthy. And before I tell you a little bit about them, I'm going to just explain to you a little bit about how I categorized the Reveal category. It was essentially, this is art about nature that is often taking place directly within nature and often utilizing parts of nature to create the actual artwork. It reveals an environmental reality without overt activism. There's not an explicit calling for action or prompting a response in any way. It's more about revealing what's taking place and the relationship, the nature-culture relationship that the artists wish to represent. And oftentimes, this particular work is categorized or depicted through images, photographs, sometimes performance and sculptures, and recycled art would fit into this category, much recycled art, landscape photography and painting. So to tell you a little bit about Andy Goldsworthy, he's a British sculptor, photographer, and environmentalist who often creates site-specific works within the natural and urban settings. And as you see here, he uses natural and found objects to create these works. He's interested in exposing the delicate qualities inherent to nature's structures and systems, and he often uses brightly colored flowers, icicles, branches, twigs, mud, pine cones, such things. Here we're seeing leaves and stone. So the first work is called, they're not really titles. They're more what he describes what he's done. Slate Arch Made Over 2 Days, fourth attempt in Wales in 1982. And then Leaves Polished, Greased, Made in the Shadow of the Tree from Which They Fell, Pinned to the Ground with Thorns in France in 1989. So photography plays a critical role here. He wouldn't be able to encapsulate each of these particular instances, and I wouldn't be able to show them to you today unless he hadn't been able to take this photograph. So he talks about how photography plays an important role because of the ephemerality of his works, and how this transient state that he captures in a moment is really, really the critical point. He tries to capture the high point of the nature within each piece. I'm going to quote him. "Each work grows, stays, decays, integral parts of a cycle which the photograph shows at its heights, marking the moment when the work is most alive. There's an intensity about a work at its peak that I hope is expressed in the image. Process and decay are implicit, because these things can't stay forever." So that's one example of an artist in the reveal category. And the work here obviously refrains from directly making a statement or urging a particular environmental point of view, but it does draw us in and make us think about the nature and the surroundings around these works. The second artist that I want to tell you about is a Canadian photographer named Edward Bertinsky. And he is really concerned with documenting the far-reaching environmental transformations that are occurring in areas of rapid industrialization globally. And he's particularly interested within that in looking at extractive industries. And that includes oil, minerals, and quarries. So I'm going to quote him here too as well. Quote, "The new human capacity discovered through the unfolding of the industrial and mechanical revolutions have enabled increasingly large-scale extractions from the landscape. We are working with a finite set of materials that are disappearing quickly. Sustainability must align with design and consumer attitudes and understanding of the material world and how we use it." So he himself, much like Andy Goldsworthy, is an environmentalist, but his work doesn't necessarily try to elucidate an environmental response from people who look at it. His whole premise is that really when we take from the land to fulfill human needs, there's a reciprocal destruction of the environment that is relatively unseen. And the reality of that destruction is not immediate to us, to our personal experiences, because therefore it's not really easily grasped within our everyday lives, even though we are dependent on these extractive industries. And so he really is interested in looking at showing this other side of human needs through his photographs. And one thing to mention is that obviously another aspect of why these wouldn't be considered engaging in consciousness necessarily is that they are subjective. The way that somebody responds to it is subjective, of course. They're terribly beautiful images in a way. And yet the process of photography that is involved in actually creating these works is not environmental at all. And that photography does require chemicals and paper and various other things. So that sort of detracts from an environmental position. These two artists, I wanted to include some sculptural works in this to express some of that side of this group. The first work is by John Dawson. It's called Plastic Bag Installations, and it was created in a public park in 2005. And he's an Australian who he originally started as a painter, but he was walking across the beaches in his native Australia and discovered volumes of debris and started to collect the debris and scoured it and washed it and then began working and making art from it. So I guess this can be characterized as recycle art. He says that his challenge was to find objects which might not have an apparent meaning, but that for him had a dialogue with nature. And so he was looking at trying to tell the story of an environmental story through these works. So these particular works that you're looking at here are totems, they're sculptural totems, and each of the encasings that he's found have been packed with plastic bags. The second artist here, Patrick Doherty, has created a work called Around the Corner from 2003. He's a North Carolina-based artist who works with natural wood structures, and he creates these monumental site-specific sculptures within the environment. And this particular work is constructed from saplings gathered from local sources around the area where this particular work is made, and he shapes them into these massive swirling forms that measure as high as 40 feet. And obviously, they evoke tree forts or caves or something within a cliff. So those are some other examples of that I put into the reveal category. Moving on to inform, this is a category that exposes environmental issues and current ecological conditions. It has a purposeful intention to subvert existing constructions of knowledge and challenging conventions of how we have a relationship with our environment and how we think about ecology. And it really does intend to elicit some sort of a rethinking or a questioning of that relationship of between nature and culture. And to persuasively educate, but without having an activist premise. So the first works that you're looking at here are by Yves-André Laramé. And these are works that she created she sort of takes a playful approach within this work. She created them in Aachen, Germany, for a project that was in conjunction with a show called Natural Reality that was exploring some of the artists who were working within environmental practices and environmental concerns. So Parks on Trucks, she worked in collaboration with a geographer, named Dwayne Griffith, to create a series of trucks that had parks on their carriers. And these were circulated throughout the city of Aachen during the duration of this show, Natural Realities. And the trucks were planted uniquely as modeled after gardens or flora designs that had been derived through historical precedents. So she looked at art examples such as the Romantic Garden, the English Garden, topiary, bonsai, and created trucks that had examples of all of these on their carriers. And so her work was really about looking at the parallels and the contradictions between culture and nature. And so she used art and science to deploy nature, which is the plants and the soil and the water, the biochemical processes taking place on the carriers, and the culture, so the actual topiary forms or bonsai forms that had been imposed through cultural practices, the agricultural crops, the history, and so on. And she mediated these through or transported them by the political economy, which were the trucks and the road networks that then carried these works throughout the streets. So she was blurring the polarities between each of these areas to engage in discourse and have people think about things out of their context and dissolve and then reconfigure the boundaries of art and ecology. And this work was intended to satisfy cultural expectations, not necessarily environmental needs. The second artist that I categorized in this particular area was Marc Dion, who really, his work offers new ways to think about established environmental and social and political orders by employing archaeological and scientific methods of collecting and documenting and then exhibiting objects. And he puts them into new classifications. So this particular work on the left-hand side is modeled, Rescue Archaeology of 2004, is modeled after the historical wonder cabinets of the 16th century that were traditionally used to display collections of rare, odd, wondrous objects. And they were often assembled for private delectation. And he reconceives this concept and in an atypical manner and draws our attention to how different constructs of knowledge or history affect the way that we engage with our environment. And so he's promoting an active questioning of of orders and classifications that we depend on to understand the nature around us. And really questioning our understanding of or our dependence on the positions of science or public or institutional authorities to derive those classifications. And he's really interested in refuting the human or the science-centric notions of the world exclusively and more trying to urge a interdependent linkage between the two. He says, a deeper exploration of our relationship to the environment and the structures effective in it, surpassing a mere objective focus, enables us to make decisions for the future in awareness of our position within a comprehensive system. The second work here is called a mobile biotype jungle, and he's obviously inverted the concept of a jungle as this untamed, perhaps difficult to understand area of land that then is being dominated over and made smaller and contained within a movable and transportable cart. So he's inverting the presentation of it, and we're seeing tiles of different bird species around it, almost in the Delft manner. So moving on to the third group. Unfortunately, the title isn't there. Sorry about that. But this is Activate. And these are ecologically activist artists who are blurring the lines between art and activism. And this work involves active, strategic, eco-conscious practices that engages the community and relies on the community in order to affect change and or think about affecting change or the way that they relate to the concerns that a particular locality is affected by. Some of these works are going to focus on the cross-section between art and agriculture as well. And it's about utilizing political formations or policy, looking at policy and creating work that emphasizes land or environmentally conscious actions. So this art really acts as a vehicle for cultural commentary, environmental commentary, and it's educative in nature, and it really does call for social engagement. And prompting a rethinking in the way that people are considering their environment and living within it or cohabitating. And it's really it's about changing the role of art from illustrating or interpreting a given situation to more actively contributing to an integrated solution that really can bring us closer to a sustainable future. So it's the notion of creating with responsibility. The first example that I'd like to draw your attention to is the group called Fallen Fruit, and it's the first two left images. The one at the top is one that they use as an iconic image within some of their press. This group was founded by three gentlemen, David Burns, Matthias Venegar, and Austin Young, and they joined in 2004 to propose one real-world solution to something that they thought was a pressing issue pertinent to their community. And they decided to be guided by the motto, who owns the fruit? And they believed that they looked at the notion of, they were interested in food, and they were interested in the notion that fruit should be and could be meant to be shared and available to everybody. And so their artwork consisted of creating maps that pointed people in cities to locations where they could get publicly accessible fruit. Where trees were available for them to pick from. And so I guess you could consider it sort of a guerrilla fruit picking. They saw sharing fruit as a way to build community and encourage local eating, as opposed to waiting for fruit that comes from all sorts of different places. They always advocated, just in case you were wondering, asking permission and being not damaging or hoarding the fruit that they did find, or damaging the trees that they were picking from. But they expanded beyond this map making, which was the initial elements of their practice, to also create other events like public jam making sessions or city billboard projects that highlighted some of these issues, and public fruit parks where this notion of shared fruit and community building through fruit picking could be further made useful and or applicable to more people. The second group, Free Soil, here did a project called Fruit, which sort of moves on from the first idea that I showed you. And this is a collaborative of artists, activists, researchers, gardeners that all have a shared interest, again, in looking at environmental relationships as they relate to social, political, and cultural issues. And they found, they basically created a project that was about piggybacking on oranges. So looking at the way that fruit carries its way through communities, and they created a pamphlet, an art, this is what you see right here, Take One. And they actually wrapped the fruit, they had a stand that they carried around through various art fairs and different places, that wrapped around each of these fruits was information about the worldwide fruit movements that were happening in different places, slow food and other various localized fruit movements, and the effects and issues of transportation of fruit and how that affected a local or global community, and then alternatives such as urban farming. So those are two sort of agriculturally based art projects. The next person that I'd like to tell you about is Dr. Natalie Jeremijenko, and she's a very salient example of this cross-section between community-based collaborative nature of art, of these contemporary ecological practices. She is an engineer, but her work crosses many disciplines, art, computer science, and environmental studies. She created this work called X Clinic. She teaches at NYU, and this took place partly at NYU, where she held office hours where inpatients could come in, and she called them inpatients because she invited people who were too impatient to wait for legislative change to come into the X Clinic to receive prescriptions not for pharmaceuticals, but for actions that they could do within their community to promote change. And so she sort of said the X Clinic provides a service that's needed and educated people about what they're up against, showing them the issues that they're, first of all, they come with an issue, and then they learn about more issues and how they can actually do something themselves from the grassroots. And so this was all, I mean, everything from local data collection to doing soil samples within some of the plants that you had in your window, to going to referrals to specific sites or art exhibitions throughout the city to learn more about some of the issues that they had brought to the table. So the I'll quote her here. She said, by licensing diverse, non-expert, and local community members to take initiative and produce appropriate and useful responses to environmental concerns, they are encouraged to bring about the change and to participate in rethinking conditions of local environmental health. The idea is that by building something, understanding the issues from the ground up, people can administer changes most effectively, and thus their personal responses to contemporary crises can be better felt and shared by the community at large. So it is, you know, it is confounding a little bit because some of this work isn't maybe considered art, but the performative element that takes place in this particular work, X Clinic, is such that she really does take on the persona and enact a doctoral role, to be a doctor and to be somebody who's prescribing something about betterment. And it's very much in that tiny space that it becomes, this is about blurring activism and art, that it becomes really an artwork, I guess. This is an example of one of the prescriptions, which was a no park space, where in an area where it was near a hydrant and on the street, they created a very temporary park where people could sit on the side of a bus stop and contemplate nature in a very strange place to have seen it in a downtown New York City. So I'm going to move now into a couple projects that I quickly want to tell you about from my trip to Los Angeles. This is a work by a group called Finishing School. It's a collective of five people who work together to explore sort of they're conflating praxis, play, and activism to engage people through participatory models. And their work is all very much about participation and engaging community members. This is a work called Little Pharma, where they were interested in looking at ways that society medicates itself. And they were interested in delving into and understanding better alternative models of medicine. So they created a series of workshops and went into a gallery space where they created these flower pots that you see here, where you could go underneath the flower pot, put on an audio, and be looking at a video that described it was perhaps a meadow, but the seed that you were seeing on the video was being described to you in the audio, and you were also learning, you were also hearing the sounds that would have been native to that particular location, birds and water and or any other thing that would have been in the landscape. And then they had a garden that they invited the community within that area to take care of over the course of the exhibition. A seed bank and a workshop where you could do such things as, you know, building your own window boxes. And while they were doing a residency at MoCA in Los Angeles, they created another work called The Drug Run, which was they invited people to dress up as their own favorite drug and to bike around L.A. to go to various different places like CVS, a Chinese herbal medicine space, a home residence, a drugstore, medical marijuana dispensary, to look at the different ways that people access the medications that they become dependent upon. And it was very much about bringing together different communities, night bike riders, of which there are many in Los Angeles, which I learned, and a group that was really interested in looking at activist practices about looking at medication. So that's one example of a collective that's doing some really interesting work. The next is a metabolic studio, which was first not a cornfield, moved to become farm lab, and then various iterations have come out of metabolic studio. And it's a signature project of a foundation led by Lauren Bond, who is an artist, and she's the director of the foundation. And it's located in a warehouse under a bridge near downtown L.A., and it's very much a interdisciplinary think tank for art production. They have a studio there and cultural performance venue. And they basically look at issues related to culture, sustainability, and health within a city and try to serve as a catalyst for community involvement and change throughout the development of their art actions, projects, and other. And so they're really dedicated to the preservation of living things, from people to plants to any other system that works to function to better society. And it really, just to tell you, Not a Cornfield was the first action, the first art action that they had, and it was about transforming this space under this bridge. They call it Under Spring. It was 32 acres of brown field just north of downtown Los Angeles, and they converted it to a green field over the course of one agricultural cycle. And it was through the creation of this living sculpture that they were able to reinvigorate this particular area and create a fertile field of corn. And so they also hold weekly salons where this community of people interested in these ideas come together and participate in a series of lectures, workshops, film screenings, readings, debates about some of these issues. And they invite artists, environmentalists, writers, filmmakers, politicians to try to really instigate discussions that will change policy about environmental issues. And the final person that I'm going to tell you about is Fritz Haig, who created a work called Attack on the Front Lawn, Edible Estates. And it was really a project that looked at the issue or the assignments that we give to the front lawn. He went into suburban areas and spoke with homeowners across the country and implored them to tear up their front lawns and to replace them with food-bearing fruits and or gardens that then could be looking at this sort of trophy space of the front lawn and creating instead a place for meeting and a place where people, families that were creating these gardens were coming out, they were spending more time outside, they were having relationship with the community in a different way because they were outside and thus conversations could happen more regularly, but they were also creating food that they could then eat and have to share with their community because they couldn't eat it all. So it was very much about the inversion of some of the things that we suppose within societal structures, the inversion of public to private, inactive to active, and then also learning about food systems and the way that we depend on food in different ways and the way that we can make our relationship with food a little bit more not only healthy but better understood. And Fritz Haig is a really interesting person with whom I spoke. He really asserts that he doesn't believe that art solves problems and that that's not really the role of art, but that art that does shouldn't be excluded from the definition of art. And so he sort of conceives, his take on art is very different. He conceives of art as a staging ground to go out and participate in culture, but also that art as is a form of resistance, and that it's a way that ultimately it's reflexive. Art is reflexive, and it emerges because it is somehow tells the story of people and of humanity, or of urgent issues. It emerges from urgent necessity, and so his art is responding to what's happening around him, and he feels that that there is a food crisis, and that we do need to reimagine our relationship with nature. And this is one example of how he creates art projects around which this change can start to take place. So those are some of the examples that I brought about in my thesis. And then I guess finally, I wanted to mention that there are a lot of different incentives that are coming up. The social responsibility by various companies and corporations, as well as competitions and public programs that are giving forums for this type of exploration within the field of art and matching it with environmental concerns. So I want to leave you with the idea that it's important to maybe think about your relationship with nature, and that there are environmental issues are very much a real and present situation that we all have to deal with within our generation, and try to think about ways that you can reimagine this relationship that you might have with art and nature, and this idea of expanding on the boundaries of how we think about art from just being, not that I'm disavowing a painting, I believe that art and all of the work in this museum, for instance, is very, very important, but this is just a different take on it and a different, maybe some more socially engaged way to approach some of the relationships that we will be facing in the next little while. So thank you. Yes, I'm happy to take questions.
The wrapping of the rice tub.
Christo and Jean-Claude. Yes, that I had a slide of their work. That I also spoke about in my thesis. I would consider that those short-term, ephemeral, temporary interventions in the landscape very much as foregrounding some of the practices that I speak about. I also think that one of the very interesting things about Christo and Jean-Claude's work is the way that they depended on a community of people in order to create the projects that they are. They're so large-scale. For those of you that aren't familiar with Christo and Jean-Claude's work, I will just take you back to one of the... This is one of their works that was Running Fence. It went through Sonoma and Marin counties in California. They do large-scale, ephemeral interventions in the landscape, and they really do need to work with policy, with various government organizations locally and globally. Very expensive, yes. And they have a massive team of volunteers that follow and help them to create them. Well, within this particular work, they were calling on people within this area to, you could walk along it, and there were various places where you could cross between this fence. And it was about trying to reimagine the way that you thought about this particular landscape. So there are many ways of reading it, but they were interested in... This, yes, yeah, and it's looking at a landscape or a natural environment, and by putting in those temporary hands into that space or interjections into that space, you imagine the space in a different way, or you're conceiving it of it in a different way, or at least they are trying to elucidate different responses to it. I would say it's very hard to wrap your head around.
I know, very expensive endeavor.
Yes.
If I followed you properly, most of the artists, not all, but most of the artists that you're talking about are artists that are not scientists. They don't have degrees in biology or anything like that.
Many of them do not. Some of them do.
So I guess it's sort of a general question, but it may not be something that you address in your research, but I'm curious as to how, particularly those artists who don't have those credentials, are perceived, how their works are perceived in other environmental actors in the community, such as scientists and, of course, people who are traditional activists, whether they're welcome, whether they're seen as sort of dilettantes who don't know the science. Mm-hmm. Would they ever get anything wrong?
Yes, definitely. And I think the the forum that art allowed, this the way that art is maybe less definitive or defined, allows for exploration that doesn't have to be necessarily right. I think that for a lot of the projects towards the end of the presentation that I showed you, they relied very much on conversations and data that they collected beforehand to create specific works. The finishing school had done a work called Mold at a museum where they did it at LACMA, where they spoke to different biologists and scientists about food and food preservation, and got a series of different, they speak to people, they read. I asked them about that. How do you collect data to be able to make the assertions that you do within your art? And I think it's very much case dependent on each of the projects, but they do as much research as they think they can. And then the beauty of art is that you can launch off wherever you want to from as much as data as you've collected. But to many of them, integral to the piece is trying to be maintain the integrity of the science they're trying to base their premise off. So I think to the best of their ability, without being scientists, they try to educate themselves before so that they can answer certain things, but also they allow the pieces, in almost every case of artists that I read about and interviewed, contemporary artists that I read about and interviewed, they ended up going in different directions from where they had started. And much of that was based on what actually came to be versus what they had hoped to come out or had thought might come out of a particular work. So I think that varies very much depending on the work. Yes, Larissa.
About that person that you spoke about at NYU, I understand she was a teacher, but also an engineer who was...
Natalie Jeremijenko, yes.
Yeah. Forgive me if I didn't hear, but how long did that go on? And who were her inpatients? How did she advertise or...
She has a network through of various students because of being a teacher across different disciplines within NYU. And then a lot of it was localized online. Much of her work is about collecting data that then can be digitized and created as quote unquote ammo to create some sort of a position. Her work is so complex and not only theory based on one level, but also based on all of this data that she collects, that it was even a quagmire for me to work through some of it. But as far as outreach, I think most of it comes from the student community that she involves in creating and coming up with these projects. But also, I mean, I was at NYU while this project was happening, and I was able to participate in the park because I saw it. And I learned about X Clinic because there were signs around the school about it. So... I think it's an interesting thing because this particular area of study within art history, within art, it's difficult to sometimes access the networks of people that are working in them. When I went to LA, I was really pleased to see that, for me, I still feel, even though I've written an essay on this, a thesis on this, that I'm, you know, tip of the iceberg. And it's this incredible amount of information that goes into it, but also... it's constantly changing because of the information that's coming through global warming, through all sorts of different issues that people choose to address in their work. So I guess I would say that this... I guess what I'm trying to say is that the work evolved... LA allowed for a small network that is quite interrelated, and there were about 12 people that I met with, and that wasn't everybody, but it was a substantial group of people, and I did feel like I had a grasp of what was happening in that particular locale. New York also has a tremendous number of people working in this vein, and the accessing the network is just a little bit more difficult because there are more. So that's something that I am learning about still, even though I feel like I understand it better than some people. I hope that sort of answers your question. Anybody else have any questions that I can help with?
Can I ask one more?
Yes.
Where did you say Fallen Fruit was based?
Fallen Fruit is based in LA.
In LA.
Yes. But they actually do a lot of work internationally. When I was unable to meet with them. I learned about them through someone who had collaborated with them because they were in Spain doing another project. Thank you all so much for your time and for coming.